Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 550. For those of you who know that my lucky number is five, I'm kind of obsessed with the number five, you'll know that episode 550 is going to be important to me. And that's why I'm joined today by Samuel T. Herrin of Future Islands. I was so excited to set this up. We'd been going back and forth on it for a month or so to sort it out. We recorded it just before Christmas, and it was an absolute joy. Like, instantly relaxed, instantly someone I could talk to for hours and hours on end. I mentioned on last week's episode, so over on Twitch, me and B. Dolan, regular podcast guest and featured on my records, he's one of my favourite humans in the world, we do a semi-regular thing called Pip and B show each other stuff on Twitch. And one of the first episodes of that was musical performances on late night TV shows, and we just spent a couple of hours just showing each other some of our favorites. And one of my favorites was the iconic Future Islands one, which is coming up to its 10-year anniversary. So obviously I talked to Sam about that a bit, but we talk about so much stuff. That's a small part of what we get into here. I'm worried that I might have got Sam's band's name wrong several times, and let me explain why in the introduction. I mentioned me touring with B. Dolan and working with B. Dolan. Another person I toured with and worked with was an amazing singer called Natasha Fox. Now, Natasha Fox's band, old band, was called Future Ages. So if I'm talking about Future Islands, I'm worried there might have been a few times I said Future Ages instead of Future Islands. I don't know if there was. You're about to listen, so you let me know, right? Make note. But either way, it's an amazing conversation. We talk about touring life. We talk about, making a living out of your art, all sorts of things. We talk about acting. It's a joy of a conversation, and you're going to adore it. I even throw in a guest question from Scottish BAFTA award winning comedian and streamer Limmy. Yeah, we're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's where you can buy my merch. It's a great way to support the podcast. We've got some really good stuff over there. We've got our whole we may not be for you and that's fine range. Our record label slogan is we may not be for you and that's fine. And that's gone down really well as merch. It's on jumpers, on hats, on scarves, on all sorts of good things. So head there. Head to patreon.com/scroobiouspip if you want to support the podcast for like a dollar or two a month. And as I said, twitch.tv/scroobiouspipio. Whether you're catching me live and having real life interaction and talking back and forth via the chat, or you're catching up on the VODs. As I said, there's so much stuff over there that's music based, that's conversation based. There's gaming as well. But there's loads that's not gaming, so head over there. It's all free. Let's get into this. What a start to the year we're having. Joel Edgerton and then Sam from Future Islands. Bloody dream guests off the back here. Let's go. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 550, with Samuel T. Herrin. Right, I'm here today with Samuel T. Herrin of Future Islands. How are you, man?
I'm doing very well. I'm feeling, I'm a little sleepy. I just landed in Los Angeles for the first time in a couple of years last night.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, it's one of those. I was trying to rope you into an early morning call from New Orleans, and now it's even earlier in Los Angeles. So, but yeah.
Right, yeah. It's a beautiful day. I didn't even think of that.
It's a beautiful day seeing friends. And last night, it was my buddy's 40th birthday coming up, so I wanted to come out here and be a part.
Beautiful. I was going to kind of ask what's going on at this time of year, because you've spent the year, you've been, and we'll get into all of it because there's a new record on the way, you've been touring. What kind of point of the year do you down tools and start to relax?
Well, it's funny because I feel like I'm relaxing all the time.
Like, yeah.
As we have progressed and I've gotten slower, I'm always trying to find, you know, find that place where I feel comfortable within myself. I mean, I that's probably just natural to the way we do life as we get older. It's like,
yeah,
when do I get to chill in my brain? And that's something I kind of found a few years ago when I was out. You know, I used to have a partner in Sweden. And so I'd spent a lot of time in the countryside in southern Sweden. And I thought this is a beautiful place, but then I quickly would become agitated. And I kind of had to be, you know, it was like, why are you agitated? You have everything you need here. And you have this peace and this wonderful, I don't know, you like to be a part of a family. But it was all these things that I felt like, it was kind of like I grew up in a small town that was mainly just like working people, farmers, fishermen, fisher people, mechanics. And I felt like it was what I was always trying to get away from. And through song, I've kind of glorified this place. The nostalgia that exists within Future Islands music is often, you know, these quiet places, these natural spaces that that I long for. And so I found myself in this place that was like kind of where I grew up, you know? It's just a provincial agrarian community. And then I realized that it was something in me that was the fight. You know, it was like it was something in me that was the problem. So I kind of had to break myself. And eventually I did find like this really calm, which to me, the calm was kind of quieting that ambition. Like I often talk about ambition in the sense of what it can do for us and what it can do against us at the same time. Like our ambition can really drive us to do all the things in our life, to take us places we never thought we'd go, or I don't know, just push us to be the best we can be within our art or our careers. But it can also like drive us away from our friends and family and completely isolate us within. So it's kind of like finding that, like, I recognize my parents' workaholic nature from when I was a kid, and I hated it, like that I didn't have enough time with them. And now, you know, by the time I was 32, 33, I was like, oh, that's what I do. You know, it's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's really interesting because that ambition is going to be what's responsible for getting you to where you are, but it's also going to be what's responsible for every time you've not taken time to appreciate where you are and what you're doing, because there's always going to be the next thing that you're trying to climb up to. Particularly, I think the music industry and the acting industry, all of these industries are so driven by competition at times that I always remember when I started doing music, I'd been working in record stores. So the dream was to just have a CD on a shelf in the record store. As soon as it was on the shelf, because we'd started to get some daytime radio play, we're looking at where we're going to be in the charts and if we're going to get daytime play, if we're going to get evening play, if it's going to be specialist shows playing us or the mainstream shows, and all of this absolute nonsense when we should be going, fuck man, we've got a record that people can buy. Like this is a real thing. This is amazing. That should be the bit that you enjoy and appreciate. You know?
No, you're absolutely right. And that's something I think about a lot and I've talked about before, which is, you know, when I was going or when we first got a spotlight, you know, this band was going almost 10 years before we kind of had a national moment. And that was through a performance on Letterman and our fourth album, Singles.
I want to talk about that because we're coming up to the 10-year anniversary of that. So it's that kind of soon. There was 10 years before and it's now 10 years on. So
People keep reminding me of that. And I was like, oh, that is weird.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it, but it is. we are at the full before and after. We're coming up in just like, I guess about 4 months now. The thing about oh my gosh, I just lost my train. What were we talking about?
I derailed you. That's my bad. About the kind of competition of it all. And now you were going 10 years before you had your big break as such.
Yeah. So yeah, I think about that time and remember the people that I would meet along the way in that 2014 and 2015, musicians who had had that moment. You know, people that we had looked up to, or you know, or are aware of at least, who would come up to us at festivals and be like, "Oh, you guys are amazing," you know. But hey, don't forget to look up and enjoy this moment because it will never happen again. And I was so buried within the work of it that I was like, "Yeah, cool, like appreciate it," you know. And then years later, I would be like, "Oh wow, I did miss that. Like I was just, you know, you're just like on the grindstone, just
it's the work
working.
Ethic again.
Yeah,
it goes
yeah,
back to can't. What you were saying. It's the work ethic. You have a moment and you're like, right, I have to now maximize the effect of that moment. So it's not just a flash in the pan.
Yeah, you're like, we can't stop. And that was, you know, we've talked about having issues with our album that came after that album. And you know, there's songs on that I think are great songs and I love them. But the issue with that record, you know, fans don't like it when you disrespect an album that they love. They're like, what's wrong with them? So I feel bad for that reason. You're never supposed to admit your mistakes as a performer. Mm. You can grin, you can smile through them in these things, but you just keep going. I know that, but you know, maybe it was a mistake to call that out, but it's to call out a time when, we feel like we had to strike while the iron was hot and just keep going. And we kind of lost ourselves within all of it, the total whirlwind of a wonderful moment, and didn't get to enjoy the wonderful moment. Like exactly what you're saying. Yeah. It's, I was talking to a friend last night at dinner, and she was talking about this idea of, you know, really when you're grasping for that thing or grasping at anything in your life, that tends to be the thing that makes it go away. And I think of it in the sense of, if you appreciate every little, like the smallest thing, the smallest joys, if you appreciate them as a success or a step up or at least a step along the way, you just have appreciation in your life. You have like a greater, I don't know, to have a win every day, it makes it so you can get through the days. The days are hard.
Yeah.
You know, life is hard and it's long. It's not short. It's very long. And we need, you know, it's just a thing about appreciating yourself and the work that you do. I think it actually makes you, it makes you progress in just a natural way, instead of, you know, if you fail to do that one big thing, you know, what is that big? Like when you get there, you might not even appreciate it, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think I'm big on, in recent years in particular, on trying to reframe things, reframe how I see things, how I perceive things, because there's so much that we can't change, but there's loads that we can reframe. And the easy example I always give is imposter syndrome. So for me, moving into acting and film and TV, and we're going to talk about that too, there's that imposter syndrome thing is the kind of fear that you're not meant to be here, that you don't deserve to be here and all that kind of thing. For me, the reframing of that was, nah, I'm not meant to be here. How fucking great is this?
Yeah.
Like, there's so many, from where I come from, I've got a stutter, all these different things, the amount of things I've done with my voice, I'm not meant to have done any of this. So now I can just revel in all of it. Every time I'm on a film set, it's like, I'm not scared or intimidated. I'm excited to be there because...
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, you're damn right. I shouldn't be... I'm not meant to have done any of this, but I get to.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a gift.
Well, that's a power. That's actually power.
Yeah.
I found on a film set is like, I'm not even supposed to be here. So if I'm not good, then it's your fault. All of y'all are quality control. So I'm going to do the best I can, but I'm not supposed to be here.
You put me here. This is on you. Yeah. And again, it's kind of the difference of working on something that's film and TV are such big productions, whereas a band and music, it's kind of in your control in some way. Do you know what I mean? You've got more creative control. It's your thing. So it took me a while to get used to being able to let go of that control by stepping into film sets and things like that and knowing that all I can do is turn up and do my best.
Yeah.
And then it's over to other people to deal with that. Because that was a weird transition from music. Like, particularly, I started off in spoken word, and that was partly because I loved rap, but had no one around here to make beats for me. So spoken word was a thing I could do off my own back.
Yeah.
And if I fail, it's my fault. And if I succeed, it's my fault. So that's a big difference of switching industries. So, I mean, how did you find that? Like, you made your debut in The Changeling. I mean, we've not even mentioned Kelly Marcel yet, but there's love. There's the most love in the world there for Kelly Marcel.
Yeah. So Kelly is absolutely amazing. Yeah. And, you know, it was Kelly that gave me the opportunity to be in the show through being a fan of Future Islands and saw us play. And yeah, she was like, I think that's the crazy asshole I need in my TV show. That's that crazy guy. So it was just kind of one of these.
I love that though.
It was just kind of one of these moments. You know, I didn't know what was happening. I was just doing the thing that I do with my friends, playing a show, and got the opportunity to audition for this television show. But the thing is, like, I had just, when I got the call from her, I had just gotten out of this relationship in Sweden. I was very confused about what the hell was happening with my life, because I'd, you know, I was engaged. I had an apartment there. I, you know, had a whole life planned, and don't make plans. that's a little the disclaimer. Don't make hard plans. You know, be open in your life to change. So if I'd have gotten that, if I'd have gotten that ask 2-3 months prior, I wouldn't have done it. You know, I would have been like, nope, I am happily with my partner through a hard pandemic. I am just going to be here. I'm not going away to, you know, you people are crazy. Yeah. I'm not an actor. But I was at that point in my life where I didn't know what was happening. You know, I had what I thought was my life kind of taken away from me. And so I was at that point of just saying, sure, why not? Like, I'll try this. I'll try that. You know, I remember hitting my agent just a couple of weeks before and being like, call up the producers, see who wants to work, you know, time to go to work. Love is dead. Let's go to work. I'm going to go to LA.
I must create art.
Yeah. That was my goal in getting out of that relationship. It was funny. I was like, I'm going to go into every single studio in Los Angeles and just go to work. And make something happen, because I wanted to cover up what I was going through. So in a way, like, when Kelly gave me this opportunity, it allowed me to do exactly what I wanted to do, which was put myself into a difficult situation and try to navigate it so that, to be honest, probably so that I didn't have to navigate my own difficult situation, allowing myself, you know, so much of my work as a writer is that personal work. You know, that digging into these feelings and these things. But I think I needed to dig. I wanted to dig into something that wasn't myself. I felt really strange in that time. Sorry, I'm kind of spinning my wheels, but it's such a weird time to think about. And in a way, like, looking back on that, you know, it was six and a half months of filming for The Changeling. There's parts I'm like, when did I do that? You know, it feels like something that happened to me more than it felt like something I did. And, you know, a lot of, I'd say the hardest part about the job was just the waiting. You know, I don't think people realize how much of acting is not, it's like 5 minutes of your whole day.
Yeah. I got, my goddaughter is enjoying drama at school, and I got them a role on a Netflix thing.
Oh, cool.
And it was a tiny role, and it was 2 or 3 days of waiting around, filming little bits. And they're in it for about 2 seconds.
Yeah.
But it was the perfect introduction to the industry. It was this is what it is. Yeah. If you're enjoying it, let's show you the reality of it. And it was exciting as well. It was exciting to be there and be on a film set. But it's also like, here's all sides of it. Now make your decision.
Yeah. Well, I think music, in a way, gave me a leg up, because, I mean, you know, like, being on the road is... Mm-hmm. You know, as you say, like, hurry up and wait. It's the same in the film industry. It's just, you know, you spend 10 hours a day traveling and setting up, and then you get to do your 1-1.5 hours on the stage. But so much of it is the getting there and the waiting and the mental fortitude to just, like, be away from everything for a few months, or not even the mental fortitude. Sometimes it's how great your powers of disassociation are to get you through. Mm-hmm. To enter the zombie phase, as I call it, which is about 6 weeks into a tour, where you just become, you do your job amazingly, but you're not really a human. You don't feel anymore. Your body is so broken that it doesn't even really hurt. And alcohol is like blood, and you need blood.
I always remember people kind of asking, because I'd give quite kind of intense performances, I'd have people kind of ask, how do you do that night after night after night? And it's like, that's the bit that gets me through everything else.
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't be able to do all of this if I didn't get to do that. That's the one bit of the day I'm living for. It's to have those feelings and those emotions, because you have to go into that zombie mode for so much of the rest of the touring life.
Yeah. You know? Have you ever done a tour working on a crew? Or anything like that? Because I did.
I drove a tour once. Okay. So I've got a record label as well. And when one of it was just as I'd kind of stopped making music, one of our rappers was over, B Dolan, and we'd just had this new band, War and Peace, release a record. So we did a label tour Yeah. And I was merch man, tour manager, driver. But yeah, I mean, it was all a low-key tour. It was like a two-week thing, but that was just, yeah, I was everything because I was like, I've done all of that and you're all kind of, you know, at different levels.
I guess if you have five jobs, it could be okay. You just like don't have any time to even think about how hard it is. Years ago, I did a couple tours doing merch for friends, bands that were bigger than us at the time. Doing for friends. But it was really like the hardest touring I'd ever done because I didn't get the chance to perform.
Get the good bit.
Yeah. And I was just like, man, I don't know how people do this. You know, it makes you respect crew a lot more. But, you know, everybody has the thing they do in life, you know? I think, like, for our sound person, Ian, he loves doing sound. That's like, that's also his show, you know? Allison on lights, that's her show. You know, she's really proud of what she does. And so it is, there is still an artistry that's very, very important to the show on their side. And also, it is funny because our merch guy who's been with us for, he's one of our oldest friends, our buddy Dan, has probably been with us about 12 years. And he is, the merch world is his world. And he's just like,
I guarantee he's meticulous, knows everything. Yeah, don't touch this. Don't,
You're like, hey, Dan, are you doing okay today? He's like, yes, no one's spoken to me. I'm very happy. It's like, okay, great, bud. Great. Yeah. Do you need anything? No, I'm fine. Bring me some bananas.
I'd get into that mode on tour anyway. Like when we'd have a new support act with us, if they were coming like in the van or whatever, on the first day, I'd kind of say, look, if I go quiet for a few days, I'm not mad. There's nothing wrong. You've not done anything wrong. I just need to go into my own world a little bit on the road because that's what I would do. But I'm always so worried about seeming rude or seeming like a diva or anything else. So I'd at the start just be like, look, if I've just got my headphones on and I'm not really interacting, it's cool.
Yeah.
Like, we'll interact at dinner or whatever else. But, you know, you get to that point on a tour where it's like, I need to shut myself off from the world.
Yeah. And that's a hard one because it's so important to remember the beginning of why you do the thing, but you can be in such pain, physical or emotional, or just, like you said, like I completely understand trying to shut off. I always remember this story. When I was about 16, I'm going to throw somebody under the bus right now. exclusive. Now, I drove with some friends to see a show. I grew up like in the sticks of North Carolina, and the nearest city was Raleigh, North Carolina, which is the capital. It's about 3 hours away from where I grew up. And just on the other side is Chapel Hill, which has I wonder if you ever played the Cat's Cradle in Chapel Hill, but
I think so.
It's like a legendary venue. And, you know, being a kid growing up in North Carolina, it's the place, it's like the first step, you know, getting to play the Cat's Cradle is a dream come true.
I saw
some of my first shows there, and, you know, I grew up a hip hop head, but I was probably about 16 and I drove with some buddies to see the Living Legends, and it was Idea and Abilities were there, of Mexican Descent opened. Like it was a, like looking back, it was, and I didn't even know Of Mexican Descent was on the tour, but anyways, it was a crazy show. But somewhere towards the front of the night before Living Legends had gone on, I saw Eli and out front, and he was on he was like on a Blackberry or something. Someone, you know, this is what, 24 years ago? He was just like on a little flip phone, probably texting with like a lady or his lady or some shit. I guess I can't speculate on that. But I went up to him and just like tried to talk to him, and he would give me like a one word answer, but I was also being a fanboy. I was like, are you Eli? I love your music. Yeah. I've been listening to your music for 2 years, but when you're 15, 16, that's like a lifetime. Yeah. So I was like, you're my favorite. And he just kept turning, till he almost did like a 360. And I was really, I was like, oh, I don't think he wants to talk. And I was really kind of injured in the moment. And then just, you know, 3-4 years later, I was in college and I'd started my first band and I was getting my first like experience with talking to people outside of a show. And it was really important to me to not do that, to give people the time. But fast forward another 10 years and I'm outside trying to smoke a cigarette before or after a show. And I've got people hounding me and I'm broken in my spirit and in my body and I'm going through something. And these people are trying to talk to me and I'm doing that thing. And then I was like, I'm an asshole. like I finally understood.
I've become Eli. It's Cats in the Cradle.
Well, me and Eli are Cats in the Cradle. But no, but the bigger thing was
Eli coming up to you before a show and you ignoring him.
Oh, that would have been the ultimate revenge. No, but the truth was, it made me feel like an asshole in that moment. But then it made me feel like an asshole for telling the story that I'm telling you right now about Eli for so many years, because I had no idea what he was going through. I don't know what his day was. I didn't know anything about being in a tour bus or, you know, in a van and traveling around with, I mean, what, the Living Legends are probably like 12 dudes all. It must be the wildest. I loved the Living Legends so much. One of the most fun live groups I've ever seen.
I was going to say, I want to get into rap a little bit because there's so much. Yeah, exciting stuff. I want to know kind of who you're into. You mentioned an idea there. One of my first kind of imposter syndrome moments was going on stage in Texas at one point to do a set. And Idea and Buck were side stage to watch. And they're just kind of chatting and interacting. And it was for Strange Famous, so Sage and B. Dolan and all that were introducing me.
Wow.
And I'm there. Again, this is... It's a weird thing because when they're all on your CD shelf, they're not real humans. So then when we're out there, and again, we were on the same label, a lot of us, so it was a normal thing, but it was the first time I'd had that. And it happened to be as I was walking to do a show. So I couldn't allow myself to fanboy out too much because I had to be in performance mode. So it was just kind of just walk past and go like, oh shit. How cool is that? And then go on and do your thing.
That's amazing.
Who are you into? Who are your influences there? Because I want to talk about your vocal influences in Future Islands and as Hemlock Earns in your rapping. Because like speaking of Strange Famous, there was a guy on Strange Famous called Curtis Plum.
Who's so good.
He's so unusual. I think you'd enjoy him. He's really unusual. But I remember speaking to him in Texas that time, and he described his main vocal influence as Katharine Hepburn.
Whoa.
Which sounds bizarre. And as soon as he'd said that, I could hear it. It's
love it.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly his voice. He's rapping in that voice.
What?
And he was from where was he from? He was from...
That's hilarious.
Iowa, I think. And he was just this weird dude. But yeah. Amazing stuff. And obviously, your vocal styles vary from when you're singing to when you're rapping. So who are your rap influences? And then we'll get deep into who your kind of your musical influences are.
Well, it is interesting because I do feel like I feel a freedom to do kind of whatever I want, you know, especially within rap because because of rap and especially being influenced and loving the West Coast styles like Project Blowed stuff that I would discover when I was, you know, 15, 16 years old, who I always thought like the West Coast underground really explored style.
Yeah.
Different than the East Coast underground. A lot of the East Coast underground was more about, I've talked about this before, like East Coast was like how hard you are or having that had a hard edge to it, at least to show, you know, like what I loved about hip hop that I connected with was the MCs who shared kind of stories of vulnerability and, you know, places that they weren't talking about what they had. And this is before the Jiggy era, which to me was despicable.
I always remember hearing Scarface do both.
Scarface
be the hardest in the world and then the most vulnerable in the world.
Yeah,
I'm hearing this guy that's terrifying me and then... I'm getting emotional as I'm connecting.
No, Scarface is an amazing example. But, you know, early on it was like KRS-One was huge for me and listening to all the Boogie Down production stuff. Yeah. And really when I got into rap, it was because of a few records. Gravedigger 6 Feet Deep was the first. Yeah. And then it was Diggable Planets, Blowout Comb, De La Soul, Balloon, Mind State, and Channel Live Station Identification, which is a really unknown record channel. Do you remember Channel Live? I think they only put out one record and it was all produced by KRS-One actually. There's a really great song in there. It has like a little child singing the chorus. It's the Alpha and the Omega. We're gonna crush you, sucker MCs like Sega. It's the Alpha. And
That rings a bell, you know.
They were so good. Their channel, I forget those two MCs' names. They were on some KRS-One solo albums, but Anyways, those records kind of were my intro in that my brother recognized that I would not stop listening to his Gravediggers 6 Feet Deep record, which I was obsessed with.
Gravediggers are a great example, though, of what you were saying about kind of not having any rules.
Exactly.
Not even stuck to reality. Like, they would go to, like, prior to people will cite Eminem or Odd Future or whomever else who will just go so weird and surreal and dark and tonally all over the place, like both topic-wise and vocally. And Gravediggers were, an amazing example of that.
Yeah, I mean, and even, then. I think, Too Poetic, who... He has some of the most, you know, because I was talking about the styles before. Like, to me, East Coast was more about like the toughness of it. And to me, like the West Coast was more about how hard you could style, like how hard you could go. Like, to me, West Coast underground looked like graffiti, you know, just like wild style. Something about it, the way it moved me. And then I realized that that was like language as a shield and a sword. And that's kind of what I saw as a child. Like with the East Coast, it was galvanizing your stories of hardship and being strong in it, which is something that I really, that's what I try to do with Future Islands. That's what I try to do on stage, which is showing vulnerability, but through masculine energy to actually play with like gender norms and how what it is to be a man, you know, and breaking down this idea. And you know, that's I'm sure not what like Karis One was going for. But when you tell a story, you know, while you were at home with your mother, afraid of the dark, I was sleeping out in Prospect Park, eating one meal every 48 hours, you know, and he's just like that's not pretty, that's not glamorous, you know. He's talking about the times that he was homeless, trying to just to eat, and how that made him strive towards his ambition to rap, to make something of his life. So that's the sword and the shield. But on the West, where maybe I didn't get the message as strong, it was people that were building walls with like tongue twisting and cadence breakdowns and like just like time signature switch ups, like, what are you doing? You know, it's like walls versus briar patches, you know, like gardens. And so that was more what I went towards, because when I was 17, 18, I didn't have anything to say, you know, like I'd be like, I am tied to the earth and the trees, you know, like these kinds of the natural raps. But then I was like, well, if I can like push style, and that's kind of where I went. At the same time, there's like Anti-Pop Consortium on the East, you know, in New York, which are hugely influential to me, and just people that create worlds through their words or feelings, like emotions, like the way High Priest's voice is just like it's like floating in zero gravity, like slowly away from the spaceship. His voice.
Well, that whole era, that kind of. I always feel like Cannibal Ox in there as well, was just feeling like...
That's still like a perfect album.
I've never heard before. Yeah, completely agreed. And it was just like, I've never heard this. And it sounds hard as fuck, but it also sounds like a trip and a dream and all these other things. It's beautiful as well. So it's got that hardness and that vulnerability in there, which is, a hell of a thing.
Yeah, I guess I'm sad that they didn't... Nothing ever really came again. That record is so perfect. And then you're like, well, yeah, that would really suck if that was the record you made. And then you're like, let's make another record.
Yeah.
We're screwed. Let's leave it there.
The problem with touring with a fair few people of that kind of indie rap scene in America is everyone knows each other so well. They know their tricks. And I was on tour with someone, I won't say who, and they just said, you know, like, because I was always like, Vast Air is just, I could listen to him for hours. They were like, you know how easy it is to be Vast Air? You just slow every word down and it sounds more impactful. Yeah. Every syllable is important. And that's what KRS did too. That's what KRS, like,
he would do that.
KRS was my number one guy as well. And it's like, as soon as people start to break it down, you go, oh no, that's kind of, it's a trick. It's easy to do here. And it's like, don't say that. Just let me be lost in the magic.
Now that is a good point.
Well, again, there's so many places I want to go around and talk about, and we've only got a limited amount of time for all decency. But what were your kind of influences with Future Islands then? Like who'd jump out to you? Because again, for me, kind of driven synth pop kind of sounds, the UK's got such a mad history in it. So I was wondering, I wonder if there's UK influence, if there's, And just as you say, in your vocal style, in the freedom there to kind of go however you want and wherever you want.
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of began early on. I mean, you know, going back, I mean, it always confuses people that they're like, oh, you're into rap music and you also rap? Like, how does that figure into Future Islands? But it's so much of the way that we've always created from the time before Future Islands. We had a band called Art Lord and Self Portraits. And it was, we would basically, you know, we were all learning our instruments together. You know, Garrett had never played a keyboard before. He was a guitarist. And William had never played bass before. He was a guitarist. I had never, sing in school or something, or like with my mom, but I never wanted to be in a band. I was a rapper. That was my identity and my joy and how I felt that I could make it, how I fit into music was through rapping. So then coming into creating with Art Lord, you know, there were a certain number of things. It was more of a conceptual art piece at first, and we were really aping Kraftwerk in love, you know, we wanted to desperately be like Kraftwerk, three keyboards, bass guitar was the instrumentation. But then, you know, like I'd never heard Joy Division until I got to college. And that smacked me in the face, like, you know, because I was like, I was just like a hip hop and jazz kid. I didn't get bands, like bands weren't, you know, I listened to some punk music and stuff, or like me and Garrett would rock like Slayer in his pickup truck and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't really know about underground rock music of any kind. I say rock funnily because I don't really think. But anyways, hearing Joy Division was like, part of it was I didn't feel like emotions came through in the same way through like band format music. I felt like, and I still talk to this day about the ideas that, you know, the thing about the MC is that it's like the only music genre where the person really references themselves. And you may take it as like, it's a big up. Like, it's like, that's part of it is like, it's just like graffiti, like hear my name, see my name. Like, this is how we get up and this is how we get known. But it's also about it's like manifesting your own personal strength by putting yourself in it and by saying it, but there's something so personal. And we're bands, and I mean, it's something that I try to do as a musician in a band is to kind of speak within a universal language that can reach as many people as possible through Future Islands. But I still am very self-referential because of this hip hop influence and those ideas about telling these personal stories. But when I heard Joy Division, it was the song Digital, and I could feel like his emotion exploding, you know. It was just like I could like feel his body vibrating with something that he couldn't hold on to. And that's what I connected with. I connected with, well, also just those bass lines, hooky baby. that propulsive force. But so Ian Curtis was a really early influence within Art Lord, but more so like within the dance of it. Like in Art Lord, I used to do the robot and stuff. I don't break out the robot in Future Islands shows anymore. People might freak out though. It'd be kind of fun.
It's time to break it out.
It's time to break it
out. Just as a note, it's time to break out the robot. Pick a song on the new album that's the one that's going to bring the robot out and see.
But it is like,
what it does.
Those early songs were, we would write a chorus and then I would freestyle the verses, you know? Mm. And that was hip hop, you know? I was a freestyle artist. So I was like, okay, cool. We wrote 8 instrumentals and I haven't written the lyrics yet, but we can still play them live. So we just go on stage and play songs and then just like freestyle it and then be like, oh, okay, cool. I kind of like that thing I said. Or, you know, you kind of like fleshing out melodies in a improvisational way, which is something that I already understood. Like I already understood that as a freestyle MC. Mm-hmm. And that's still like part of how I create today, which is kind of that. It's that first strike of when the guys send me, you know, when Garrett sends me an instrumental, I only have to listen to about 15 seconds of it. And then I'm like, okay, turn it off. Like, don't listen to any more. Yeah. And then wait, whether it's a day or 3 weeks or 2 months until that time where I'm like, okay, I'm sitting down. I feel something's in me. I need to write a song. And then I'll put on that song. And the thing is, I don't want to overplay it and burn it out.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever did you freestyle? Was that a part of?
No. Okay. And I never had that angle of it. Again, toured with loads of people who are amazing freestylers, but yeah. I was always the kind of, yeah, just I'd want to go away and craft. I think it's like I used to do
understandable
stencil art rather than graffiti art, and I think that plays into it. It's the equivalent. I wanted to sit at home and create every intricate part and have it all under my control and then present it rather than have that freedom.
Are you Banksy? Did you just, is this a soft disclosure?
Genuinely, I had an episode of this podcast where people thought we had given away the identity of Banksy.
Oh, really?
And it got reported on the news in America, in Australia, all over Europe. It was amazing, but. Yeah, let's go with it's me, and we'll see if they run with it this time.
That's funny. Yeah, but it is like that thing. You know, that was the way we all kind of brought something to the table from our different different backgrounds. Like Garrett was a metalhead. You know, he didn't listen to like Euro pop, which is kind of what Art Lord was. William was the only one who really understood the kind of synth bands and the kind of world that we were actually, I don't know if I should say aspiring to, but kind of where our sound kind of fit. William was the only one who kind of understood that because he grew up with two older sisters who, like, you know, his first cassette was the Thompson Twins. And, you know, he was he was the one who showed me Joy Division. He showed me The Cure. And then there's people like The Cure. I didn't get them till I was probably about 20 years old. And then it just like hit me like a ton of bricks. And like Robert Smith is such a phenomenal, for me, such a phenomenal writer. And his mm-hmm. ability with his voice is uncanny. And he still does it. Like he still has strange, powerful, amazing voice. High voice. I don't know how he does it. But you know, the influences are all over. I mean, there's probably even a little bit of like Ghostface bad singing is an influence on me. Been way too long.
Oh, I was going to say, again, you know, the things just that the freestyle element makes so much make sense, because if you're improvising singing, it's going to have that freedom of where the tone goes, of where things go, because you've not got the... Do you know what I mean? If you've got the words written out, you know how that goes. If you haven't, you're going to go tonally up and down and deep and high. And that makes sense for that starting like that is the perfect starting ground to build to then become your style as such.
Yeah, yeah. Because I am like, I mean, then that's the funny thing is so much is like the things that I learned through MCs and style and something, you know, I'll still write a song like probably the last... You know, this is a unreleased material, but the last song that I wrote for Future Islands, I was really proud of it because I was like, hey guys, here's a demo and this is a different style than I've done before. And that's pretty cool to be 18 years and 21 years into it with those two guys and be like, I found a different style, a different cadence and flow and approach. And, and you know, I think when you allow yourself that, it just opens the possibilities up. You know, if you feel that you need to, we have a sound, this is the way we sound. And, you know, Future Islands does have a sound, you know, within the music and within the messages, within the stories, there is a pretty strong through line. But I take that as us defining ourselves. I feel like when you hear our music, you're like, that's Future Islands. And I think that's great, you know, in a world where there are so many bands that probably form every day and just trying to make a name for yourself and be, just trying to be yourself. I mean, that is so much of, once again, like rap for me, which is just that holding on to your space in this world and feeling like you can share your voice, that your voice matters, which is another message of Future Islands. But it's, you know, it's something that we practice to show people, you know, not to tell people, but to be like, yeah, we can, you know, we're just four kind of normal looking dudes and we're doing this thing and it's really cool. Like that is a powerful place to be. And I think if you open yourself up to people or just natural with people or natural on stage, you know, sans fashion or trends, and you just like stick to your guns and try to be honest and sincere about who you are, that's something that gives people, it gives people strength to see that. At least I believe, you know, these are definitely ideals, you know, it's idealistic, but yeah, I mean, if I can hold on to some idealism, then then yeah. It's okay. This world will beat it out of you.
You've got, you can see on my face a slightly glazed look because my mind's been blown by the realization that you're equal parts Ian Curtis, Robin Smith, Ghostface, and yeah. Bismarck.
And Grand Poobah, don't forget.
And Grand Poobah, yeah, it's that perfect combination. I love it. Well, I want to rewind back. And again, it is something you will have talked about so many times, but one of my favorite things in the world is really great musical performances on late night TV. And the reason for that is because they're quite rare, because it's a really weird scenario and weird situation. Mm-hmm. Like the one late night show we did when touring in America was the Carson Daly Show.
Okay, yeah.
And it's not a natural situation for performing. Like I enjoyed it and I saw it for the first time in years recently. I was like, yeah, that was all right. That worked okay. But it's so unusual. Like there was a Shakira performance this year on Jimmy Fallon that blew my mind. But as said, you've got one of those on Letterman
mm-hmm.
10 years ago. How did it feel getting booked for that? And then how did it feel after? Because as you say, you were 10 years in your career. A lot of these things, it is, you know, you've got that new band energy.
Mm-hmm.
What did you feel going in that you had to, or did you feel that this is your make or break kind of moment at this point? Nah?
Nah, I mean, I think part of the power of that performance and why it came off in a certain way and meant something to people was the fact that for what we wanted when we went after, you know, music as a lifestyle, the goal at 23 was to start taking the band serious, go on tour and make our art our life, you know, live off the art. And by the time 2 years before Letterman happened, we had achieved that. And yeah. You know, it was different. You know, I often talk about this, like when I was 26, 27, I think I dealt with a lot more like envy and jealousy and mm-hmm. the want, like seeing other people succeed and wanting just like a piece, you know, just kind of our albums were overlooked by music media. The press didn't really care about what we did, but we kept going. And we were shown by our friends, like first our friends Valiant Thor, who were a North Carolina band, who just went on the road for years and, you know, and they achieved a success by just believing in themselves. And then it was our friend Dan Deacon who showed us, who was more like kind of in our world, still a very close friend. Yeah. And the score, he did the score for The Changeling, which is such a cool connection.
Yeah.
Dan also showed us, you know, I feel like 2006 and 2007, which is the first 2 years of when we switched over to Future Islands, he did something like close to 220 shows a year for 2 years straight. And at the end of that, he, you know, he got all of this press. And because the thing is, like, when you have those moments, if you've never played a show, if you're this young band, then you're just kind of, the people watching, they can connect on the face level of whatever the performance is, but they don't have any frame of reference, you know? And there's no, like, history to go back into a young band. Like, for us, or for Dan, you know, we saw it with him first. When he found success and people were championing his music in the press for the first time, I think with his record Acorn Master and then Spider-Man of the Rings, mm-hmm. which is such a wild record. It was like, there's thousands of people around the country who are like, I saw that guy play in a basement, you know, like yeah. he played in my friend's living room. And that's like the frame of reference. The same thing happened with Letterman for us, where people had those moments. They were like, oh my God, I saw these guys, you know, play to nobody somewhere. And they weren't lying.
And here they are.
Because for years, we played around the country to nobody until we were playing to some people. And then it was more people. And then we were actually living off of these shows. And then we finally got the opportunity to play Letterman. But the thing was, the last album before that was put out towards the end of 2011, and we had been told that we were going to get Letterman.
Right.
We'd been told that it was coming through, and then it just never materialized. And that record kind of went under the radar to what we had hoped it would do. There's part of me that still thinks that is one of our third record, which is possibly our most experimental. I used to think it might be the best record. Now I'm feeling really confident about the new record, but there's something about that record, but it largely went under the radar. And because of that, we felt like the label didn't get behind it and these things. So then we made the change to 4AD. And then once again, they're like, you know, we're going to get you on Letterman. And we're like, sure, whatever. Like, it doesn't matter now, you know, it doesn't. And they're like, yeah, well, you know, you should do it if it comes through. And we're like, okay, what, you know, whatever. Because we'd achieved these things. But what I was going to say when I was 26, 27, I really wanted this thing. I was grasping at this thing as we were talking about earlier. Yeah. And then by the time I was, Letterman happened 2 weeks before my 30th birthday. And I was at peace. Like, look, we made this thing. Like, we built careers on our hard work. And like, we found people around the country and all over Europe and the UK who really care about our art, support our lives. Like, we made it, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that being in that place of peace, like, and feeling like it wasn't like we hadn't pulled the wool over someone's eyes, you know, had done it on our hard work, that helped that calm kind of settle in our lives. And then we played Letterman, and then everything exploded for a year or two. And then I got lost in, you know, in the insanity of that moment and went back. You know, that was the hardest thing about after Letterman was kind of, I reverted back to this, oh, people care. And I lost myself for a couple years in trying to once again, perform for a perceived audience, you know, this new perceived audience that, you know, that actually they aren't the ones that are going to support you. The audience that was already there are the ones. And there will be people that you pick up in those moments that discover you and continue to discover. You know, that clip is still going around. But, you know, there are lifelong fans that have been made because of that. But it's not because of you're writing for them. It's because of what you were writing before.
You what know? You were already writing, who you were then.
Yeah, as you said,
the timing of where you'd got to.
Exactly.
And again, completely relate there. I always remember the first time I said, with me and Dan Lesac, our first single was the one that blew up and got in the charts. Mm-hmm. But even on that journey, we have originally got picked up by the late night shows, like radio shows, by Zane Lowe, by Rob the Bank, by all of these. But then we got some daytime airplay, and then we started to think that that's what we needed.
Yeah,
but it was only in halfway through the second album, I think, that there was the realization. It was like, well, if Zane Lowe plays us in the evening, it will be to a quarter of the amount of people that the daytime will hear, but they'll be our people.
Exactly.
If we're being played in the daytime, it's a load of people who are probably going to go, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Why is this on my... So it's a bigger audience, but it's not our audience. And you realize that it's better to be in the right place than be in as many places as possible at once.
Well, it depends on I mean, some people don't mind it. That spotlight really... And I made peace with that. But the thing about being in the spotlight is that you have twice or three times or four times as many people to be critical of you.
To give in an opinion.
Part of being an artist, you know, I believe, you know, when you go to art school, I went to art school, you have to go through a critique. You know, every piece goes through a critique. It is part of the process. So I also have to accept that is what happens. And also the other thing is when you create true divisive art, that's like making real art. You know, if you create something that's polarizing, that pulls people in different directions, then you actually create something that creates its own conversation. You know, so if you have someone go, I hate this, and you have someone go, but I love it, then there's a fight, and then you can step away and let them hash it out. And then their friends get involved on both sides. And then random people are like, oh, well, I need to check out this art. I need to see this thing. And then it just creates its own thing. That's what happened with Letterman.
Yeah.
Not by our hand. We were just doing, once again, like, we were doing what we did and believed in. Yeah. You know, the one thing about that performance was most of performing it, I was just trying to, I was like, is my zipper up? Do not slip. Do not fall. And then I was in my head going, are you going to do the growl? Nah, you shouldn't do the growl. But maybe I should do the growl. Nah, don't do the growl. I feel like I should do it. Nah, don't do it. And then I was like, well, it's done. And so
that's fascinating to hear.
I don't even remember you know, I kind of just was in a transcendent blackout state during the performance and just completely in my head, just like connect with the audience. Don't fall. Are you going to do the growl? Don't fall. Connect with the audience. If you watch that clip right before my first line, because we had to cut the intro down for television. So it just kind of, it clicks in and and goes straight to it. But you'll see my, I'm left-handed with the mic. On my right hand, I touch the top of my belt, and that's to check to see if my zipper is up. Because I literally think it's just like, oh. And if you watch the King of Sweden clip, which was our first time back on that stage, it's for the Colbert show, but it's the same, the Ed Sullivan Theater. There's a part where I kind of lean forward and I check if my zipper is up, and it's not. And then luckily they clipped around it, but I had to zip myself up one-handed and I just cracked the biggest grin on TV, just like, and nobody knows why, but it's like, that's because my fucking dick was hanging out.
I love that. I love all that going on in your head, because it's kind of, it means you, the performance that you subconsciously gave almost is exactly what you were talking about earlier of the masculinity and vulnerability all mm-hmm. presented in one kind of thing. But I mean, it's perfectly timed that you were talking about that kind of, that it's then there to be debated. A good friend of mine is a Scottish comedian, Lemmy, who's fan of you guys.
Oh, I know about
Lemmy. He loves you guys. And I kind of hit him up, and he wanted to say that when he saw you on Letterman, he loved it and was absolutely gobsmacked and didn't know what he was watching in an exciting way. And he wanted to ask if you have ever watched a performer that's given you that kind of feeling, that kind of, I love this, but I don't know what it is. Like, I know for me, the first time I saw the jazz musician Christian Scott, who I'd collaborated with but had never actually seen him live, I then watched him and was just like, I don't know what this is, but it's the best thing in the world. And similarly with Curtis Plum, who I've picked up a couple of times now, and you're going to go and listen to and not know what to expect. But yeah, have you had anyone that you've watched in that way and kind of been like, right, I've not seen, I don't know what this is, but I can't look away and I fucking adore it?
I feel like I must have something really deep. I mean, that is what I got when I heard Ian Curtis, and then I shortly after saw Here Are the Young Men. It was it's that small like tour. It's not really a doc. It's like some early performances. And I was like, what is he doing? What is happening? Yeah. You know, dancing in and out of, you know, a single light, you know, he's like disappearing and kind of like bringing that epileptic fit. I was just, I did not understand that. And seeing The Cure, like it was in Orange, which I think is like 83-84 concert. That was when I realized that Robert Smith played the guitar. And I was, I just had always imagined him being just a singer. And then I was like, oh my God, he is ripping the guitar and he's singing these crazy lines. And then I was like, I need to learn how to do something else because I can't play any instruments. Part of what I do as performance is because I don't have an instrument. And so I feel like, I believe that if you are a front person and you don't play an instrument, you better do something. Like, do something.
I learned a load of like Prince and At the Drive-In kind of style mic stand tricks and little kicks and flips of the mic.
Love
purely
stuff.
Because of that, because of my own awkwardness. Because I'm like, well,
yeah, you gotta do
because
something.
The person I collaborated with was amazing producer, there'd be these big instrumental bits. And it's like, if I'm on the mic, I'll move, I'll do everything. But if I'm not on the mic, I don't know. I don't know how dancey I'm going to get. So it's finding those things from artists like that, far more talented than me, and going, right, here's what I can add.
Yeah.
And the buzz of that was always amazing. The kind of, I'd do a thing that, I'm sure I stole it off Cedric about the driving, that I'd let the mic kind of hang down, and then just before it kicks in, with the outside of my heel, I'd give it a little kick.
Nice.
Spin up and catch it in my hand as it kicks in. And I was like, it's my fucking favourite move, but for a rap show, no one's doing that. And that's what I love, because I grew up on punk and rap. So, always trying to bring those two energies rather than simply, like you mentioned, Antipop Consortium earlier, one of my favourites, but I always remember seeing them live and thinking, do they know we're here?
Yeah.
Because
they're just like, create their own world.
So kind of contained and creating their own world. So yeah.
Totally.
It's that mad thing.
But I don't, I'm really bad off the top of my head with like, with this kind of stuff, but it is, you know, I think mine, performances that have really affected me and performers were those that I spoke about, but also, you know, James Brown, like you watch the Tammy show, and I want to know how to do that. Like, I don't know how you do that, how the body does that. But also like watching, you can watch Elvis. There's that famous return. He had the famous return where he played on like a circular stage in the middle and he's in like all black leather. And black I watched that years ago. And he just does this move where he's like close to the front or this audience and he looks so in pain and a single tear rolls down his cheek and the crowd, the women are just like gasping, screaming. And then he just smiles through this tear. And I'm like, performance, this is amazing. And those kinds of moments of, I mean, for me, it's more, I don't think I've ever seen a performance and been like, well, that can't be true. The what are you doing? I'm trying to bring my head around that side. Cause it is like, I like weird stuff and I like people to go out and I'm always mining for what is the truth of an artist, why what they do is important so that I can better understand my own self as an artist and like seeing people's freedoms. Cause I believe that, you know, some people ask me, you know, why doesn't everybody perform like you? And I'm like, well, then I wouldn't be interesting. And also it's about the person, you know, I think I bring my personal truth to the stage as I believe that it should be performed. But I don't think, I think if you write a song honestly and, you know, are sitting at a piano and singing it or speaking it, then it's going to come through. The emotion comes through from the pen, you know, it comes through from that original place of writing. The movement is a way of telling the story. The dance is a hook. You know, the dance is a way of grabbing people's attention so that then you can tell them something important so that you can hit them. So I think lots of musicians work in very different ways to create those hooks. Then maybe they don't even recognize that that's what they're doing, but it is, for me, it's all about grabbing people's attention so that you can tell them something in any way you can, whether it's, you know, something that, you know, we did a tour recently opening for Weezer and they were so sweet to us and we felt, you know, honored to, you know, they asked us to play these huge shows with them, but we're like, this could get weird. I don't know what the crossover is. And it was, the first half of the tour was kind of rough because their fans did not like it. They were just like, what is this clown man doing? They were like, music's okay, but this guy's, he's weird and disgusting. I don't like it. And I had to like reassess. I had to deal with this thing that I hadn't dealt with in a while, this pushback. Because the other thing is when you do create a world for yourself with music, you get to exist in that world. Yeah. And as Mike said, you know, if you're always during that tour, he's like, you know, if you're always playing to the choir, then you don't really have to go through any adversity. So we had to we had to deal with it, like feel it. And then we actually became better because of the tour, because we had to double down on what we did and be like, oh yeah, well, this is what we do. Like, I'm not going to change what I do for you. Cause for a few shows, I was trying to like tamp it down a little bit, make it a little bit easier. And then I was like, nah, I'm going to rip faces. We're ripping faces off.
And then the ones you went over are worth all the more. I always remember in a 1 year period, me and Dan supported LP, Saul Williams doing a spoken word set. Wow. And we were doing our full set. Billy Bragg just, guitar crazy. And Billy.
What is this tour?
And Mark Ronson. Like, these were all different tours that we sport. And Mark Ronson, doing his full jazz band thing.
Okay.
And it was like, this was all within 1 year. And it was just us going, right, well, we're not going to be able to adapt for all of them. So we need to just go out there and do what we do.
Exactly.
There's no band who can adapt to fit all of those. So it's exactly that. You have a load of people in the crowd going, the fuck is this? And like the Billy Bragg's one's the best example, because we started and I swear 0% of that audience was into what we were doing. And by the end, we had at least 50%. Like, I'm not saying we had 100%, but we had over 50%.
That's a great achievement, like, though. I mean, that's the thing. Yeah, if you can do that, buzz. You know, that, and that's why those kinds of tours can be special.
Yeah.
It's just like reaching. I mean, I was surprised how many young kids were at those shows. And then I was like, you know, maybe we turned on some kids to some stuff they didn't really know. You know, I don't know what's happening.
It's the mad thing with some of those bands though. Like my goddaughter, who's like 13 or 14, I think now, when she put up her Spotify Wrapped recently, she had Weezer Buddy Holly in there. And I was like, that would have been on my Spotify Wrapped when I was 13 or 14.
Yeah,
like,
that's really cool.
How is this still? And I think that we've Green Day are always an example of that for me as well.
Yeah.
Like, I was into them at school. I'm not necessarily into them now, but kids at my that are at that age are still, they're the best band in the world. And Weezer are a prime example of that as well. It's that
that's
mad
a good point.
Longevity, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Green Day's still on the charts. They're still charting.
It's insane. Well, I mean, we're going to have to wrap things up, but we've not talked about your new album at all. And you've...
I don't care.
Sent it through for me to have a listen to, and I loved it.
Thank you so much.
Tell me a bit about it. Tell me about what the album is, what your approach has been. Yeah, talk to me.
I'd say the approach is, we didn't really approach this album any differently than the past records, but the thing that was born into this record just because of the state of the world was time. Mm-hmm. You know, in the old days, we'd write a record, you know, just be on tour all the time. You'd be on the road for 2 months, you get home for 2 or 3 weeks, and you say, well, I'm tired of that set, so let's write some new songs. We used to just get home for a couple of weeks, write a couple of songs, take them on the road. If they lasted the tour, you know, maybe only one would last, maybe they would both die very quickly. Then they became a part of the set. And then you're out there, then you get home, write a couple more songs. And then, you know, if they exist at the end.
Then
this was the process for our first three albums. And, you know, once we got 5 or 6 songs, we would go about to record them. And while recording those songs, we would flesh out the rest of the record, which is why like our first three albums are all, they're like 8 and 9 songs, you know, there was space to do more, but there wasn't time or money or, you know, those were all recorded in friends' living rooms and skate parks and this kind of thing. So with singles was the first time that we went and recorded in a real studio. And, you know, we got off the road, we took almost a year off and wrote and recorded an album. And then that became the new style. But what happened with As Long As You Are, our last record, we were supposed to put it out at the beginning of 2020. And then, of course, the pandemic happened. And then it was like, well, how long do we hold on to this record? You know, do we wait until the pandemic?
What do we do?
You know, because there was no idea when the pandemic was going to be over. So we ended up putting it out at the end of 2020. Because also for us, like, kind of have to put out a record to be done with it. You know, like once the album is out, then you can't futz with the mix, you know. Mm-hmm. you just have to accept that that's what it is. And then that acceptance allows you to go forward and write new songs. So by the time that record was turned in, it was middle of 2020 or early 2020, and we started writing. So the first year and a half of writing was the first 7 songs. And they were all kind of dealing with the space. Like my ex was in Sweden. And for the first 6.5-7 months of the pandemic, I was unable to get back to her because of border closures and lockdowns and all this stuff. Finally able to get back for 3 months, but then I had to leave for 3 months because of visa. Then I got back for 3 months. Then I had to leave again for 3 months or for 4 months. And then when I went back the last time at the end of 2021, we split up, you know, this time and distance. And it just like, it was a weird, it was kind of like one of those things looking back, I saw that I should have seen it coming, but I, you know, and when I looked at the songs, those 7 songs that were written up until this point over the pandemic, I'd seen them as these love songs of 2 people apart that were holding on, that it was going to get to, we were going to get to the end together, you know, through this hard time. And then we split and I was like, oh, that's not what those songs were. These songs were me like desperately holding on, or like trying to remind a person like, hey, remember that we have to, you know, not that she didn't feel that. We both felt the same way, but it was like, I think I could feel that she was slipping in that distance and just like how hard it was, like, you know, the disassociation to get through the time and just the everyday agony of not knowing, just like fear and anxiety. And so when we split, those songs became very colored, very, very differently. They started to mean different things, and I could really divine them in different ways. But, you know, after that, the last 5 songs were written fairly quickly. I think the first 4 were written within a 2-3 month period. And then the last song came in like June, July of 22. which is, I actually recorded that song in when I was in Toronto filming. And it's the only time I've ever, I recorded the demo on this mic. And when it came time to record it in the studio, I asked the producer, like, can we keep it? Like, can you, it is the vocal good enough that you can make it sound like it's in the world? Because, you know, this is, I'm just like on a, it's my travel rig. But I was like, I'll never be able to capture the emotion of that day in finishing that song and recording it in a city that I don't live in, you know, in this new isolation, in this new world, completely separated from this person that was, I thought, my life. And now I was just like, can you use it? And he's like, I'll do my best. And it ended up working out. And I can't even, I feel like maybe we did try to take it and it was just like, this doesn't sound the same. And I'm like, it's not the same.
Yeah.
You know, now
it's
we're
always the risk of falling in love with a demo, isn't it? And again,
you got
to
watch out.
If there's something is there, Dan Lesak, who I used to work with, kind of stopped sending me early versions of his beats because I'd fall in love with them. I'd write the whole thing to this thing and he'd go, no, it's not finished yet. And I'd be like, no,
you're
but
like,
it's
don't
perfect.
Touch
he's like,
thing.
He wouldn't let me have it until he was happy with it because he's like, otherwise we're just going to end up arguing. It's like, I don't want you to hear a version that
totally
I'm not
true.
Happy with and you fall in love with because of the moment in which you heard it and what it meant and what it inspired at that time. So
yeah.
I love that you got to use that still and got to push that through.
Well, yeah, and that was something me and our co-producer Steve Wright had talked about on As Long As You Are, where he was like, you know, at some point we need to get you a pro rig where you're set up, and when you have those, because he's like, there is a difference. Like when your demos, the quality is not great, but the emotion is like so much better than what we capture in here.
Yeah,
you know, on
it's really interesting.
On average, it's like, you're going through a thing. And it's true. Like, you know, when you write a song, you're just like, oh, you're feeling it. You also haven't quite figured out like how you want to make it sound better, which is like more approachable. So it has like another layer of a rawness and a simplicity, which actually those kinds of elements hit harder, you know, when it's, you're not trying to soften the edges to make it more palatable. You're just like have that raw idea. The way your voice breaks because you don't have the pressure of like, oh, it's going to last forever. So it doesn't really matter. But that throwawayness is part of, I mean, that if it is a throwawayness that is in the quality of your vocal, it's probably because you're trying to throw away a feeling. And that's exactly, you're capturing you throwing away a feeling. Yeah, it's just fucking demoitis, man. It's real. It's hard.
Yeah, it's a tough thing. I always remember the original version of this song, Thou Shalt Always Kill, that came out was just recorded in my bedroom at my mum's house. And then we had to re-record it when we were doing the album just because the rest of the album was, you know, it didn't sit in there.
Yeah.
And I struggled massively with it because it was like, but that's the one that that's the one everyone else fell in love with. Like, so demo artists has got into everyone else, if you know what I mean. Like, we didn't keep this to ourselves because it was the MySpace era. We just made it, uploaded it. Here you go. It's like, now we're doing a new version that, I don't know. Everyone might also think, oh, why have you done that?
What's
the point in that?
It's tricky. I think because we had to upload two of the early singles, which, you know, came out long before the record's going to come out, they're going to be like remixed, you know, nothing drastic, but I know there's going to be some fans who are like, I want my other mix.
The original.
Yeah. So it's like, what are you going to do? Because we ended up, so we finished this record really close to the end of 22. I thought we were 2 days away from finishing the mix. And then William, our bassist, had the idea to remix the whole album with another mixer. Great. So we broke out the checkbook and in the spirit of let's make sure everyone's happy. But we ended up creating this hybridized version from kind of where we were with our buddy Steve Wright, who, you know, co-producer, mixer, and then our friend Chris Cody, who did our album singles. Mm-hmm. And they have very different styles of mixing. Like Steve, what we had achieved with Steve was this kind of clarity in our music that we'd never gotten before. Like you can really hear every voice of everyone within the band. You can hear all of Garrett's sound sparkling through. There was just like it was something that I was really proud of with As Long As You Are that we had created with Steve. And I felt like we had gotten better with this new material. But then in hearing Chris's mixes, we kind of lost the clarity, but he was bringing this, like, there was something to his sounds that were just like thicker and like stickier. And he brought some kind of, it was like an intangible vibe, but it was like, but the dynamic is off, you know, like we had worked some of these songs. We had worked with Steve for like a year and a half mixing. Two of the songs were already out, you know? And then you're like, how are you going to, you know, there's no way I'm going to unhear a finished mastered song that's been out for 2 years. And now I have to hear a new mix of it. Like, this is messing with my head. So then we approached Steve and Chris and said, is it crazy if Chris mixes from Steve's mixes? Because, you know, when you have somebody mix a record, you zero out all the effects and all the levels, and then they just go from scratch. But we had already done all the work to make these songs super dynamic, super clear. And I thought sound really good, but there was something about Chris's sonics. And both of them were basically like, well, people don't do this. And then we're like, we know. Are you willing to do it though? And
that's amazing.
And they basically were like, yeah, well, like Steve was like, I relinquish whatever will help this project, you know, reach the finish. I'm happy if, you know, this is on this, people don't do this. And Chris was also like, it's pretty weird, but I'll give it a shot.
Yeah.
And I think it was, I think we really achieved that. Like Chris added a heft while not taking away from the movement and the dynamic movements of the record. And for me, you know, Chris made our most successful album. Steve, in my opinion, made our best sounding album up to this point. So I'm like, if these two guys can work together and we can find this compromising place, then we're all the better off. You know, it's kind of the best of these two worlds. But the most important thing was that we were still all happy, which I now have two albums that I'm really proud of the sound of. You know, I think, and I think for all four of us, you know, there's always something there with the first five records. Somebody has a problem with something. You know, it doesn't, you're just like, I wish I had sang that differently. I wish my bass tone was different. I wish they hadn't remixed my drums that way. I wish my keys were, and you know, As Long As You Are, the goal was, because we had all the time in the world because of the pandemic, we made sure that we made a record that all of us were proud of and had no issues with. And then we somehow did it again, even after a major overhaul at the last minute.
I love it. I love the kind of people don't do it this way, and you guys being able to go, yeah, but can they?
Yeah.
Can we do it this way? It's a beautiful thing, rather than take that of, no, that's not how it's done. It's like, it's not how it's been done.
Yeah.
But how about it's how it's done here? If, you know, it's what's right for the project.
Yeah, precisely.
I love that.
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, it's about sucking up egos for everybody too. You know, I knew at that point, like, William would not allow it to exist as it was. He needed to have one more touch on it. But also the guys and myself weren't willing, but I think the guys more so, Mike and Garrett, weren't willing to throw away all of this work we had done. And I was like, how do I say, how do I stick this together? You know, like, and so I was just happy that they were willing. And you know, I think we hit our manager first and he was like, yeah, that they aren't going to go for that. And so you were wrong, Ben, you were wrong. I was wrong. You heard it here first, folks. Ben was wrong.
100% wrong.
But yeah, I'm proud of the record. It's so dense with emotions. And that's, it's a strange world when you do this press cycle and you start doing interviews and you have to like actually figure out what the hell your songs are about. And then you're like, oh man, this is sad.
Particularly after such a broken period as well. And as you said, the kind of the reframing of what they're about, even because of where you are when you wrote them and versus when you recorded them and so on and so forth.
Still like it, you know, these albums reveal themselves over time and songs reveal themselves over time through the playing them. You know, these songs haven't even reached their finished point because, you know, I guess 7 or 8 of them haven't even been on stage yet, you know.
I'm giving big nods here because I truly believe,
you know how they change.
If I could re-record every album after a year of touring them, I would. Yeah. Because that's when so you find harder. The finished song. Yeah, that's when you find what this song is meant to be. I've had it numerous times that a song has come on when I'm out somewhere and it's one of mine and I'll be like, is that how that goes? Because that's not that's not how it ended up going. After touring it for years, it's like, that's not how that goes at all. Like, what's happened there? Well, I mean, we're going to have to wrap things up at some point. I kind of want to ask what's ahead, but I assume it's a load of touring. You know, new record tends to mean hitting the road again.
Yeah, we haven't announced many dates yet. I mean, part of the album title, People Who Aren't There Anymore, is also about like us as musicians. Like we're in the future. Like we're not really planning to tour the way we used to. You know, we have prided ourselves on being a band who is going to be in your town or near it. Doing our best to, just try to play everywhere. That's not sustainable anymore. For me personally, my leg is destroyed. So I've had a torn ACL for about 8 years now and that's turned into like advanced arthritis and it's just very painful vocal problems. So it just takes, and I'm about to be 40. It takes longer for the body to recover. And it's not going to get easier. So like doing 150 shows a year is not a thing that I can do and be on this earth. So we are paring down to like 50, 60 shows a year and going forward and just trying to make those shows really count. Make sure that when we do play, it's at 100% because I feel terrible when I have to give anything less than what I think I'm capable of. And it's not about going well. I'm always going to give more than I got, but it needs to be something that that is consistent. And I don't feel like I'm inconsistent, but there is a pain that goes into those long jaunts on the road now, and I don't want people to see that pain. I want it to be a joyous experience and not one that I have to channel something darker to reach people. I don't know if that really makes sense, but sometimes
perfect sense.
Yeah, I feel like there were some times, not even last year, but the year before that, where I was on the road and being like, I just want to, I want to die, and I don't know how I'm going to go on stage tonight. But it was just like, just put it in the performance, Sam. I'm just telling myself like, just let it out, and like, I'm right, and it's a good lesson, but also. I don't want to be exercising this. I don't want to exercise pain. I want to exercise. I don't know. I do want to exercise pain, but I'm trying to say I want the pain to come from the pure places of the songs and trying to reach people, and not from the decay of my body, which is the decay of my spirit.
Yeah, from the experience of touring itself.
Yeah, exactly. So I just want to be at a more positive place. And the guys feel the same. Garrett's a father now. So it's also important for him. Also for me, because I want to be a good uncle to be like, you should be there for your kid. Like, let's not be gone for 4 or 5 months of the year. Like I want for you, and Garrett's a great father, but I want for you to be a good father and be there and be around. So yeah, we're just getting older, but I've got a crazy rap album coming out sometime in May or June.
Exciting. Again, we've hardly touched on your rap stuff, but you've worked with people like Madlib, who are just icons in this world. So, tell me a little bit about the next rap album.
The next record is with this guy, Icky Reels, who's a Cleveland, Ohio producer. He's very different than... Actually, the funny story about it is he's a DJ producer for Beans from Anti-Pop Consortium. About 3-4 years ago, Beans hit me up out of the blue and asked through Instagram and asked me if I would feature on a track of his. And I was like, hello, what's up? Like, we'd never spoken before. He just like hit me and I'm like, you're one of my heroes. Hey. This is crazy. So we did this track together called Anti-Star System, which is bonkers. You should check it out if you haven't heard it. And then through that process of making that song, he was like, do you have anything? Like, have you been working on anything? What's up? And I was like, I have this whole Madlib album that I don't think is ever going to get released. And he's like, I'd love to hear it. And so I sent him this Dropbox file folder. And he was basically like, this is fire. This is great. Like, why isn't coming out? And I was like, I don't know. I think he just moved on from it. And these things are just kind of old songs now. They're like seven, 8 years old. They finally actually got released in the last year with a buddy. But he was basically like, well, no disrespect, because like Madlib is the god, but I think that you can do, I think that you're better than these beats though. Like, I think you can, you know, because of what I did with him on Anti-Star System, which is, you know, more of that kid of who I was, like tongue twisters. And but there's messages within it. It's not just showing off, but just like crazy styles. To Matt, I'm like fucking Beans from Anti-Pops. I'm like, I got to bring it. I probably stole a little bit from High Priest. I was like, let me be a little High Priest here. But anyways, so he's like, he basically was like, I think you need to be challenged more. And he started sending me, he's like, if you're willing, I'll introduce you to my buddy. And so, so me and Icky Reels started to collaborate on some ideas back in probably 21 was the first stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's very different. It's just like very acidic, industrial sounding beats with weird time signatures. You know, some songs that are like, there's a couple of songs that are like 7 minutes long and go through five or six different changes. And I'm just like, what? I mean, I really had to push myself to match the strange landscapes and energies.
That's great.
I'm curious what people are going to think of it. It's not like a thing that you will be heavily consumed, but I don't really expect that. You know, like that's the joy of rap for me now is that even though it's my first art form, I'm not known for it. I'm still like, I say, what is it? There's a song that I put out over, it was one of these old Madlib songs, but the way my voice compressed in the deck, my voice sound like a vet, but you ain't heard it before because I've been hiding out in the storm, picking up the pieces of yours till I found my piece in the floor, heartbeat from the floorboards. Vonnegut to Poe, Chris Parker to Daniel D. Kerrison. But you know, it's just like, you haven't, I'm a veteran, but you don't know.
Yeah.
You have no idea who I am.
I've been here the whole time. I've been here 20 years.
Yeah, you haven't heard it. So there is that part of me that I just love to explore without, you know, once again, that's the power. Like as coming into an acting role and being like, I'm going to do my best, but you know, you wouldn't know any different. So, and I think with rap, like I've explored so many different styles on different features and different projects because no one knows how I'm supposed to sound. But it's a power because I already have my career. So I get to enjoy rap and explore it very fully because I don't have to feel that I need to achieve something other than being honest to myself, which is how lovely is that?
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing, right?
Yeah.
I love it. Well, I appreciate you taking the time, man. It's been a pleasure to finally meet and chat. And I look forward to catching up again soon in the real world, no doubt.
In the real world. Let's do it. It has been such a pleasure, Pip.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we bloody go. What a guy and what a story and what a speaker and what a conversationalist. I loved that. I really enjoyed that conversation and I look forward to more of them. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Very excited. The new album is fantastic. And I'm excited to catch them live because I've never caught Future Islands live. And I should have. I had the opportunity twice and was going to go, but couldn't make it last minute. But next time I get the opportunity, I'm going, I tell you that. And check out Changeling on Apple Plus. It's good. It's good. I recommend it. I'll be back next week with more amazing guests. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.